Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 2, delivered on January 15th. Tonight, the world of finance. To begin this, as will be the case in almost all of the lectures, we look at the screens, the markets. What do they tell us has happened today? It can become sort of a normal routine in a business person's life, especially if you are in any field that's related to finance. And that would include things like marketing, it would include operations, management, production, human resources. There's something to be seen here, no matter what field you're in, if for no other reason than you see where the economy is going. From day to day, it's usually just this day was like this. But once in a while, you have something dramatic happen, and that's what we kind of look forward to if it's a dramatic upsurge in the market, and we dread the day that we see something that is an unbelievable crash of the market on the downside. There's more likely in the short run here, and we'll talk more about that tonight, good days, but almost all of the sophisticated traders know that the end is coming. That doesn't mean that we run and hide right now. That's not how investment works. In a way, there is... Look, I am a financial economist. I taught economics for many years. I spent a lot of time consulting in the world of economics. Economics has what is called utility theory, and you were all introduced to this. We maximize our utility across the goods and services that we consume, scaled by the prices of them, et cetera, and ad infinitum. Finance does not work the same way. The financial mind doesn't work the same way. We work in a way that would be seen by a traditional old-style economist, even a psychologist, as irrational. But it is perfectly rational what we do. But it can lead to some very bad things. The way we think is the same way the gamblers think. It's the same way that drug addicts think. There's nothing wrong in that except that there's something bad at the end of it. Look, madam, you are in a casino. Have you ever been in a casino?
No.
Okay, trust me, it's glorious. I mean, it's just like, many, many years ago when I was in the service, I got a chance to go to Vegas, and I went to one of those casinos. There's no windows, no clocks, the whole nine yards. Got to see Sinatra and all that kind of stuff. It was wonderful, but there's something about it. You see, suppose that you're in a casino. Now, you have money that you're going to put on the table to gamble, and there are all these tables. Believe me, there's something for everyone. There's 21. There's poker of different kinds. There's keno. There's anything you want. Okay, now, you know that sometime during that long night that you are going to have fun, you are going to bet and lose everything. You know it. Probability 100%. However, you know that the next table you bet on, you will have a very good chance of winning at that next table. And then once you finish winning at that table, you walk to the next table and you know that you have a very good chance of winning at that table. At any given next table you go to, you have a very good chance of winning. It's just that at some point during that long night, you will get your clock clean. You will be P-O-P-O. And you will never be able to see your family again. And you will no longer be able to pay tuition at Illinois State University. You'll have to go to Heartland Community College. And you will no longer be able to shop at Walmart. You'll have to shop at Aldi's. I hate Aldi's.
They put your food in boxes on the floor, and they make you pay a quarter for the damn card. I mean, that's just degrading, really. But anyway, okay, so now, you have won at this table, and there's that next table. Are you going to play that table, or are you going to walk out the door with your money? Tell me. You are? Wow. No, seriously. Actually, there are some people, normal human beings, who would take their winnings and walk away. But most people are sure as hell not going to do that. I smoke. That next cigarette, oh, God almighty, oh, that's a good cigarette. And I see that there's this cancer going boom, 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 boom. And it's going to pop out my mouth someday in the next 20 years, and I'm going to die of cancer and diabetes and a heart attack all at the same time. That's how my life will work. But I do know that the next cigarette's going to be wonderful. So, of course, I'm going to smoke it. The same thing is true. Gamblers, addicts, and finance traders all work the same way. We know there's going to be a crash. We know it. It's going to be spectacular. It's going to probably be worse than the one in 2008. But it's not going to happen today. It's not going to happen tomorrow. So we're just going to keep plowing forward. We're just going to keep going. Today, I know darn well there's going to be a really bad correction. We don't call them crashes. We call them corrections. But I went long today. A really, really risky stock. I went long on it. Knowing as I do that I'll win on that, and also knowing as I do that I'm going to keep playing these kinds of investment bets, and sooner or later I'm going to have so little in my portfolio that my retirement is going to be cat food in a cardboard box. And then my cats can find their own cardboard box. Of course, they're good. They're cats. They'll find a box. Okay, so always keep these kinds of concepts in mind. We think somewhat differently than you as normal human beings would think. It's a rush. And it's called a process addiction for us. When I put that money on the table at 12 o'clock, almost noon on the button, and at the end of the day, that small amount of money, $65, had turned into $212, God, that's a rush. Of course I'm going to do it again and again. Until the day that they find me twitching along the gutter on the side of the street with no money. Now, let's look at this. Was this a good day or a bad day on the street, sir?
It was good.
It was broad-based. In other words, all of these markets were up. Do you see that the markets were all positives? You saw green. So does that mean, madam, that the bulls or the bears were in charge today? Say it.
Bulls.
Yes. Don't be afraid. If you're wrong, I'll just say, God, you're stupid. No. It was a bullish day on the street. The bulls were in charge. However, it wasn't really a major upswing. I consider about 0.30% to be the difference between a really good day and one that's just kind of meh. Yeah, it was up a little bit. But and as you can see, the Dow was strong. The S&P 500 was not as strong, and the NASDAQ was even weaker. There is an interesting thing to look at right there. Now, again, the Dow 30 is the 30 largest companies on Earth. Massive, oligopoly/monopoly type of companies. Now, the Standard & Poor's 500 is huge companies too, but more diverse, mid-cap to large cap, as we would say. And get used to this terminology. Before you even understand how to use it correctly, start using it. That's how language works. And I do see that the Russell, which is small caps, generally speaking, was up pretty strongly, but we'll ignore that. Look right now, if you see whatever good news was affecting the market today, it was tilted toward the larger caps. Do you see how the largest companies in the world did the best on the day? And then the mid to large did not quite as good, but they still did good. And then the small caps, the NASDAQ is mostly small cap companies, although there are a couple of enormous companies in it. The NASDAQ didn't do very well. It went up, but it was just barely up. So in other words, whatever good news was affecting the market today, it was better news the bigger the company. So I can see that. Now, the next thing that you have to think about when you're looking at these kinds of numbers, these screens, is the question, okay, money was flowing into stocks. That's why the price was going up. There was demand pressure. Demand goes up, price goes up from basic economics. So in other words, we had money flowing in to the equities, and that's a fancy word for stocks. The equities were the beneficiaries of inflow of funds. But if there was an inflow of funds, the question would be, where did the money go out from so that it could go into equities? That means that we have to look at the two major alternatives out there. Now, the two major alternatives to investments in stocks are, first of all, bonds. Bonds are, as a rule, safer than stocks, and we'll get into that in detail later in this lecture tonight. So, in other words, if you were afraid that the economy was going to go to hell, you would bail out of the riskier equities and move towards the debt, the bonds. That would be called flight to quality. Flight to quality. Moving out of riskier investments into safer investments. So in other words, if I saw stocks going down and bonds going up, that would be a flight to quality. In this case, though, I see stocks going up, and the first question I would ask myself, well, does that mean that investors were getting out of bonds? So I look at a bond index. Spank me, Jesus. Look at it there. See the bonds? They went down. This was a reverse of a flight to quality. This was positive sentiment, getting out of the safe stuff and stepping into the waters that are a little bit more turbulent. Because you're going to make more money if you take more risk. Bonds are safe. That means that they're not going to return so much. In this case, there was a sentiment that it was worth moving out of safety and into the riskier waters. So this was a reverse flight to quality. And it's a positive sign for the economy in the short run. Investors are saying to you, we are bullish on this economy. Now, there's one more in there. If you are afraid that the economy is going to go to hell, the first thing you would do is go from stocks to bonds. That's a stage one flight to quality, from stocks to bonds. However, if you think it's going to really, really go to hell, you're going to get out of bonds too. And the next thing that you will go to is metals, gold, silver. So the flight to quality, stage one, is from stocks to bonds. A stage two flight to quality would be from bonds to metals, bonds to gold. There's an old saying from years ago, from stocks to bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. Let's hope we never have to get to the point where we are selling our gold so we can buy rounds for our weaponry. So you keep an eye on the markets like this. I think gold did okay today, but it was for other reasons. Really? I'm not looking. Is it that hard for me to find? Oh, yeah, gold and silver both did. They were up, but they were up for, it might have been a little of that money coming out of bonds, a little bit of a hedge, maybe put a little of it into the gold and silver, but probably that was for other reasons separate from the economy. It's pretty clear from what I'm seeing here that the sentiment was to get out of safe instruments and move some of that money into riskier securities. I did today. I mean, I took money out of some really super safe bonds, some government stuff, to buy a very risky stock. So my behavior was mirroring what the a lot of other investors were doing for the day. But anyway, this gives you sort of an idea of how the markets can be read to tell you about the economy. This is better than listening to politicians, to listening to news talking heads. This is better than even asking your mom. Even though she's very wise, I'm sure she is. You see, in this world, the only thing that matters is making money. And when it comes down to that, your sentiments are gone. You can't care about who's in charge in Washington, or what this talking head says about the economy, or what they're saying about some trade negotiations. You look at this, this is the bottom result. Anything else is fluff, because this is where you either eat or don't eat. Your pension fund is either good or it's sinking. This is where lives are made and lost, is in these numbers right here. That sounds kind of cruel and harsh, but that's just the reality of it. I'm going to take all of your money, sir, but I love you. I really do. But give me your money or I will shoot you. Now, does it matter that I said I love you? No. What matters is that you no longer have money for that Red Robin cheeseburger. And those are good cheeseburgers. Yeah, I'm serious. I stand outside the window there and I just look at the people and I grumble to myself, that's right, you eat that cheeseburger, brah. Okay. Anyway, you see, all the talk in the world is irrelevant to us in finance. In other parts of business, it is relevant. To us in finance, it doesn't matter one bit. And we're going to get a lot, I'm going to get a lot harsher with this when I get to some topics that are currently hot about corporate governance, and I'll probably get to that today too. But for the time being, well, next week I will start showing you actual individual stocks, and we'll read the stock charts for the stock screens for specific stocks, learn the terminology, learn how to look through the screen and see the information that is being shown on the screen, interpret it, make decisions about investments from it if you want to, however you want to play it. The first thing to do in the regard to all of this is, and I brought this up, just kind of snuck it in there, and now I don't even know where the heck did I put my stupid marker. Did anyone see? Oh, I put it back in my pocket. Okay. Look, when I use the term securities, I'm referring to financial instruments that represent claims on assets or liabilities. So a stock, a share of stock, is a security that represents ownership. But ownership really doesn't mean much. It represents your claim on the residual cash flows of the company. So if a company has, at its bottom line, let's say $5,000, it's paid all of its bills, and it has $5,000 left, and it has 100 shareholders, each of those shareholders has claim 100 shares outstanding. Each shareholder owns, and I'll put that in quotation marks, each shareholder one share, let's say each of them has one share, owns $50. You following with me? Okay, now, the company is the entity that decides whether to give that to the shareholders as a dividend or to plow it back into the company as reinvestment. The company itself makes that decision on behalf of its shareholders. So in a case like this, I could choose, for example, to give a $10 dividend and then take the other $40 and plow it back into the company as plowback. Now, you see, the more I give you as a dividend, sir, do you like getting checks in the mail? Yeah, I do too. You see, I make my shareholders happy by giving them a check. But the more of that money I give to you as a check, the less I have to put back into the company to grow the company. And that's the only way your stock can increase in price, is if I grow the company. So in other words, it's a trade-off. Young companies generally do not pay dividends, because they are plowing that money on your behalf as the shareholders back into the company. And so In my days of consulting, I helped little companies go public. And in some cases, I would take companies that were dead, and I would slide into the dead company, what we call a public shell, a living private company. It was a sneaky way of turning a private company into a public company without going through all of the SEC filings for a company to go public. It is a nightmare to go public. We'll talk about it in this class. I did take companies public, but sometimes the group with which I worked, we would find a dead company that was publicly traded. It still had a trading symbol. And what we would do is we would take control of it in a hostile move. And then we would tell the shareholders of the dead company, look, you might not like what we're doing here, but I promise you that you're going to have a better chance of making something off the stock, because right now your stock is worthless. At least this way, we are putting a live company back into it and breathing life that might make the stock price go up someday. And then we'd say, okay, do you want us to do this? Vote us in as the controllers of the company, give us a pile of shares and make us the directors, or say no and walk away crying because of that investment you made 30 years ago that lost you so much money. Typically, the shareholders would say, yeah, we'll do this. We're game. Okay, that's fine. Now, in some cases, though, down the road, these were young upstart companies that we'd put in. They were barely alive as it was, and they were struggling to get together enough money from borrowing and from offering other stock. And we'd go to the shareholders' meetings after 3-4 years, and the company was breathing. It was beginning to take life, but we didn't have money to give them a dividend. Every penny we made in profit, we put back into the company. And so you'd have these shareholders come to these meetings, and they'd be angry. You said when we did this that we would begin to make money off our stock, and we haven't seen a dividend, and we have lost everything, and we get no dividend. Where are you in terms of getting us some money out of what we've invested in? And you have to be professional. I would just say, this guy was just yelling at the shareholders meeting. I said, you know, I'm a professional. I said, look, you asshole, we're trying to do this the right way. We're growing the company. This is going to eventually cause the stock price to go up. And then maybe someday we'll make enough money that not only will your stock price go up and you'll make money off that, but we'll also start paying dividends. But not now. Companies famous, they're not paying dividends. Netflix doesn't pay a dividend simply because it's plowing every penny. Matter of fact, Netflix is so thirsty for money, I can't believe they're still able to find suckers to lend them money. But there are a lot of companies in that same boat. They don't pay a dividend. They're growing. They're young. They're highly, highly risky. Because you see, if you get a dividend, that kind of takes away a little of your risk in your investment. If all you're doing is riding the stock price up and down, that's dangerous as hell. Good. Okay, so it's a trade-off. In general, the more you see as a dividend, the less you're going to expect the company to grow. Now, some companies give very, very generous dividends. A company, for example, like Target gives almost half of its earnings back to the shareholders as dividends, which is kind of amazing. I wouldn't give you 50% of my profits back, even if you are the owners, but they do it. And then there are companies that give just a little tiny dividend just to shut everyone up. And then there are companies that pay no dividend. But understand, it's a trade-off. Equities investments are risky. You can put your money into a company, and the company can just simply go down the toilet, and that's it. You don't get to do anything but cry. The other side of capital, we have the equity side. These are the owners, the shareholders, the stockholders. The other side is the debt. The company borrows money. It can sell stock to raise money, or it can borrow money. Know this. The debt holders have to be satisfied in a timely manner. before the shareholders can claim one penny. The debt holders have to be satisfied in a timely manner. Whatever you owe them this month, you have to pay them before the shareholders can say, mine, nothing belongs to them unless the debt holders have been shut up. And here's the reality of it. If you are a stockholder and the company does you wrong, well, I'm going to sue that company. No, you're not. You are that company. You can't do that. You are the owner. That corporation is you as a body. Not you individually, you as a body of shareholders. You can't do anything except bitch and write on message boards. This was a real rip-off investment. The debt holders, on the other hand, they can shut you down. You don't make an interest payment on your debt. You don't pay your employees. They will haul you into court, and the court will turn you off unless you get bankruptcy protection. And in bankruptcy court, the debt holders control everything. The shareholders are sent away. You're gone. And then the debt holders take control. So if you don't pay the debt holders, they will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your parents wear furry costumes. They'll do everything they can to you, and I guarantee you I've been parts of that. I've been involved in that. We'll just destroy the company. And sometimes we'll set up a company that's too stupid and desperate for money, and they'll take our deals for debt. And then what we'll do is we'll also take stock. Then we'll pump the stock up, sell it off, and then starve the company by rearranging their supply chains, and the company will eventually die. And then we'll just take it over and destroy it, chop it up, and send it to the winds of wherever we can sell the pieces. That's what happened with Sears. That's what happened with Staples. Private equity firms do that. That's our job. As one famous line, a couple of lines in the movie Wall Street, a young man seeing this happen said to his mentor, why are you wrecking this company? And his mentor looked at him and said, because it's wreckable. So if you don't want to face that, then don't make yourself easy for us. That's just the way it is. Because we don't care. We are the we don't care bears. The debt holders have the prior claim on cash flows. The debt holders have the prior claim on cash flows. The shareholders have the residual claim on cash flows. The shareholders have the residual claim on cash flows. Now, do you notice that I repeated that definition several times?
Yep.
You know why I do that?
So we write it down.
Yes, and because it might show up on a quiz or an exam. I'm not saying it will, but I'm saying it will. So when I repeat something, that means that it's rather important for you to write it down. And it's a core concept, yes. Shareholders have the residual claim. You notice that I do write on the board, but sometimes I don't, because in your business lives, a lot of what you hear is going to be coming at you as oral communication. And that's why I want you to keen up. And that's one of the reasons I want you off those computers, is because you're not going to be paying attention and grasping context as we go along. Okay, so that sets it up. Equity and debt markets. Now, let me do, before I get too involved in this, but do know that debt is safer than equity. One good reason is because the debt holders have the prior claim on the cash flows. The shareholders just get whatever's left. So that's one of the big reasons debt is, as a rule, generally, safer than equity. And oftentimes, and that's why, look, I told you last time about some of our different concentrations and different areas of finance. In financial planning, one thing that's pretty good as a rule is that as we are looking at a client, aging in his or her life. Madam, did you know that someday you will be very old?
Hopefully.
Well, I don't. In your case, probably not. No. Absent something weird happening. As you get older, we will probably move you away from riskier investments and towards safer investments. And when you're younger, we'll put you into more stocks, possibly even speculative stocks. Simply for one reason, you have longer if you take a hit on a risky bet that doesn't pay off, you will have more time to recover. But when we get you into your 60s or 70s, most of you will probably live to be about 100 to 115, 120 years old. And so by the time you get into your 70s, 80s, we're going to be moving your portfolio toward more bonds, toward more stocks that pay big dividends, which means that they're not going to have as risky a price volatility, more toward what we call fixed income investments. And so that's a practical reason for understanding this distinction between debt and equity. It sort of governs, you ask yourself, let me ask you, madam, are you a wild and crazy kind of person, or are you a conservative, risk-averse kind of person? What would you say? You're conservative. Interestingly enough, we found over the past 20 years, we've always assumed young people are much more willing to take risks in investments. But we also know our learning, and this is something we've learned from marketing as much as anything else, and from sociological studies, that you as young people are getting much more risk averse as time is going along. Hence why in marketing, we tell you that using this product means you're wild and crazy, you're extreme, you're freaking nuts cases. But what we really send the message is everybody else in your age group is using this because we know you're scared to death of being outside of the herd, of being noticed. So what we do is we market you as if you're crazy, wild risk takers. But at the end of the day, we're subliminally sending the message to you that, don't worry, this is safe to buy because everyone's doing this. Okay? So, because we are understanding that young people are getting more risk averse over time. And we don't see that trend changing at all over the next 20 to 30 years. Okay, now. Markets. Well, how did the market do today? There are all kinds of markets. The word market can mean many things. And there are these binary distinctions when we talk about types of markets. I go to the market every day. I usually buy something to eat, but that's a grocery store market. When I'm talking in finance, usually I'm talking about the markets like the equities market versus the debt market. But I could also include in there the commodities market. Commodities are physical things. But that brings us to another distinction that I could make. The difference between commodities markets and financial markets. Sir, have you ever eaten Kellogg's Corn Flakes?
Yeah.
Good. I do too. I like them. Frosted Flakes are a little out, too much sugar these days, but they are great. But in fact, I should patent that, trademark that. But in fact, you participated in sort of a really small secondary way in a commodities market, a grain market. Now, on the other hand, if you buy a share of stock, you were in a financial market. I teach the worst course here in finance is FIL 347, derivatives. It's taught only once a year, and this is the semester I'm teaching it, as I do. And in that market, you see the difference between highly speculative traders called derivatives traders who work in commodities like pork bellies, corn, oil, things like that. You name it, there's a derivative futures market for it, and coffee beans, thing, versus those who work in the financial side, interest rates, currencies, things like that, that have no physical existence. This distinction between the commodities and the financial markets is quite strict. Now, they do affect each other, but they are distinct markets, and you would probably specialize. In your lives, you could almost think, well, do I work in a financial world or do I work in a commodities world? If you work for a bank, you're working in the financial world. But if you work for a company like, I don't know, like Kellogg's, you probably would be working in a commodities type of world. Things versus non-things, in a sense. Other kinds of markets that I could talk about. Now, this is where we begin to fine-tune your meanings of words. There is common knowledge and understanding of what words mean. But in our world, in business, and in finance especially, and even in a lot of other fields, the words take on much more precise meaning. And this is one, this next one. When I talk about the money markets versus the capital market. The money markets versus the capital markets. Now, in this world, money is short-term funds, less than a year. The money market is the market for funds that are less than a year in duration of investment. The capital market is the market for long-term funds. So if I am in charge of a company that needs $100 million to fund a new factory that will develop and then produce a new product, that would be I would access the capital markets to do that, because those funds would be used over a long period of time, and the investors would have the expectation that they would realize returns over a long period of time. On the other hand, there are money markets are very common. You are in the money markets. You participate in money markets all the time. You go to the store. You buy something that you're going to eat within the next week or the next day or the next 2 hours, and you pay money for it, short term. In the investments world, there is a strong distinction between the capital markets and the money markets. Let me give you an example. In the world of retail, oftentimes a company will need money that they will pay back within a year. Good example. Many, many, many retailers, most of their money comes during the Christmas season, October, November, December. However, they have to keep the lights on, the bills paid, they have to build inventory for the nine months before that. So what they usually do is work with a bank, as I do, where we set up a line of credit. We are borrowing money every month until we get to the point where we start to make very strong revenues, and then we start to pay back off that money. By the end of an annual cycle, we're back to the start, and we do it all over again. In my particular business, as an artist I will my money I make in the spring and summer and early fall. The rest of the year, I got nothing whatsoever. So what I have to do is set up a revolving line of credit for about, in my case, about 10 grand, so that during the cold winter months, I am simply building my inventory, paying people to do stuff for me, to create the prints of my art, doing the framing, paying the storage fees and all that kind of stuff, going out in the miserably cold fields and doing the photography or the artwork. And then I start making my money with the spring shows. And as the spring goes on, I make money and I pay off my bills. I don't give myself anything at all unless I've paid my monthly payments on my revolving line of credit, paid my payments on all the other things that I have to do. However, you see that I am actively participating in a money market. This is how so many retailers live their entire existence, just simply going from year to year. Car dealers do this. Furniture stores, boat dealers, anything where there is a, you need a lot of money to put stuff out there for people to buy, and then as the people buy it, you are able to pay off that money that you borrowed through typically through an annual cycle. And it is not as easy as it sounds, because predicting how much you're going to make can be very speculative depending upon the economy. We're always victims of the economy. For example, 2-3 years ago, I was doing really well at the shows. This last year, it was not good. People were getting defensive in their spending on pretty things for their houses. So there you go. But anyway, that's money versus... Now, another one, a good example. Companies that are very, very large will borrow money for 30 days. It's a very normal thing. It is so common that we even have a name for the securities that they issue. It's called commercial paper. Some company like Microsoft might need $70 million for 30 days. They simply issue $70 million of commercial paper, and these short-term investors gobble it up. And then 30 days later, Microsoft pays it off with some interest. That's all there is to it. That is a classic money market. It is enormous. And it's all over the world this one operates. A little sneaking thing I just put in there. A borrower is the seller of a debt security. The borrower is the seller of a debt security. The borrower is the seller of the bond, the note, or the bill. The lender is the buyer. Otherwise, we can say the borrower is the issuer of the debt security. And the lender is the investor in the debt security. Another way we could say it is that the borrower is the writer of the debt security. And the lender is the purchaser. Now, this is very different language from what is commonly understood. Another thing that I should bring up here. When I say a bill, I'm referring to something that is less than or equal to 1 year. A note is between 1 and 7 years. Although I've seen 15 years called a note recently, but you know, that's kind of weird. And then a bond is more than, say, 10 years. I mean, like I said, it's kind of fuzzy in here. However, you, sir, decide that you want to buy a nice car on, let's say, a 6-year loan, you are going to sell to a bank a note. The bank is going to invest in your note by buying that. What will be the price? It will be the price will be what you need to borrow to get the car. Okay? It's a very different thing than what people think of. Well, you, madam, go to a bank. You want to buy your first home, a nice double-wide trailer on the outskirts of Decatur. We're talking, you know, double-wide, and, you know, it's got a bathroom that's connected to the sewer system of Decatur, which means you have to put a stopper on the toilet, otherwise you get everyone else's. Anyway, you understand that you are the writer of a mortgage. Now, we call it a mortgage because it's backed. It's asset-backed. If there's no backing with a hard asset, it's called a debenture. But I'll talk about that later. I am the banker. You come to me, and you write a loan agreement. You say, I most certainly don't. They have the paperwork right there. No, they're just transcribing it on your behalf. Because once those papers are ready, you will be the first to sign it, representing that you are the writer. You accept responsibility for being the writer. And then they sign it, guaranteeing that they underwrite, they buy that piece of paper from you. The security there is that promissory bond. And it's a bond because you're going to borrow the money for 20, 30 years. You follow that part. So you are the writer of a collateralized bond. Sometimes we call them mortgage bonds. So in common parlance, you borrowed, you got a mortgage. But in technical terms, you issued a 30-year bond, and a bank bought that 30-year bond from you. So you become the seller, and the bank is an investor in you. You follow the logic? So if you borrow, I hit you up, madam, for $20. I'm good for it for next week. I am the writer of the note. You say, well, I just kind of lent it. We didn't write anything. Doesn't matter. It's still a security. There was an oral agreement, which is every bit as good as a written agreement in a lot of cases. So, okay, was this a bill, a bond, or a note? It's a bill. Okay, so now, the next thing, was this a mortgage debt or a debenture?
Come in.
Was it a mortgage debt or a debenture?
Debenture.
Good, because there's no collateral on it. Good. It's actually, once you get the hang of it, this is how it makes it a lot easier for us to talk about these things. When a company borrows massive, insane amounts of money, what it actually does is it issues bonds. And then the bond market steps up to the plate, the debt market, and they buy those. In other words, they are the lenders to the company, and the security is that bond that they have in their hands. A bill. Sir, have you ever gotten a bill in the mail? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I do too. You know, they go right to the trash, you know. Lol. They want me to pay them something. Okay, well, I got a bill for my electric. No, you didn't, actually. All you got was a memorandum reminding you that you had issued a bill to the electric company that accumulated a certain amount through the month as you used it. The electric company simply allowed you to build a debt to them. And then at the end of the month, they'll send you a notice that you issued them a bill, and they'll remind you that it is now time for you to retire that bill that you issued, that they were willing to provide you a service for. That's how weird it gets But the bill isn't theirs. The bill is yours. You're just getting in the mail a reminder that you've got a bill. You issued a bill for your internet, for your electricity, for your gas, for whatever. That's all it is. That terminology, and I'll keep using it, and you'll get used to it as time goes along. I wrote something down here I wanted to bring up. I'm not sure I want to confuse it anymore. Oh, yeah, I do want to bring up one thing. Look. Madam, you got any money on you? I kind of like to go to Denny's tonight. I really like Grand Slam. You got, don't got, you know, any? Okay. There's no financial intermediation that's going to occur here. Because simply in this case, my deficit can't be matched to her surplus. So a financial transaction cannot occur. But suppose that she did have $20, but I don't want any more than 10. So still the match wouldn't happen because she wants to lend 20 and I want 10. Okay, now let's take the next thing. Okay, we agree. You got 10, I need 10. So we've met the level of a match. But the next thing is, I'd like to pay you back next week. And you say, no, fat boy, I want to be paid back tomorrow. I hate it when people call me fat boy. No, fat boy. So in this case, we met the first criterion, the level. We missed the second one, the timing. Some investors want their money back very quickly. Some investors want their money back not quickly. So we missed the time. Oh, you say, okay, fat boy, I'll take it next week. Okay, thank God. Whew. But then she said, now wait a minute. Aren't you that mentally deranged professor at Illinois State University who gets himself in trouble every semester because of one thing or another? Last semester, I caught my face on fire. It wasn't my fault, okay? And then the semester before that, I can't even describe what happened, but it was bad. You'll get used to this as the semester goes along. Things happen in this class, and they're not my fault. Oh, you're not going to lend money to me? No, I don't lend. I got a no money to crazy mofos rule. Damn. I got the level, I got the timing, but I blew the risk. Some investors don't want to take risk with their investments. Others are willing to make large risks. So in other words, in order for a financial match, a financial intermediation to achieve, in other words, a matching of a surplus with a deficit economic unit, financial intermediation, the matching of surplus and deficit economic units, the three criteria are level, the amount, the timing, and the risk. You understand that?
Yeah.
And so that's why we need very dense money and capital markets so that we can make these matches in a blink of an eye so that you don't even see the match being made. The one thing we want to make sure is that in as many circumstances as possible, we have transactions happen without the people involved really knowing that it happened. Understand something else here too. Surplus and deficit economic units. You can be both at the same time. A good example would be that a person who needs to borrow money to buy a home. Well, in that case, that person is a deficit economic unit. That person is in need of money. Of capital, I should say. However, that person also has a 401k with $1 million in it. So that $1 million is providing liquidity to others. So in that instance, that same person who is a deficit economic unit with respect to one transaction is a surplus economic unit with respect to other transactions. So you can be both at the same time. That's why we have capital markets. Now, banks are one of the most common ways for capital of financial intermediation, but they are by no means the only way that financial intermediations can happen. In other words, the matchings. Banks are one way they can happen, but they can happen by a lot of different ways. You, madam, might say, I know someone who has $10 who can lend you for Denny's on your terms and with your risk. You would be a financial intermediary in that case because you would make a match based upon level, timing, and risk, but you're not a bank. Banks are typically thought of as the ones that do it, but by no means, sorry, they are not. Ow, that looks like it hurts like hell. Okay. Yeah, I am glad I looked at, I wrote down, make sure that you don't forget this time, financial intermediation. Now, let me try it. Let me ask this question. Sir, you, right there, yeah, the handsome young man. Okay, the guy next to you, no, not him. Okay. Why would you buy a stock? You want to make money, right? Okay, you greedy son of a bitch. You understand that's why you buy. You don't buy stock because you love a company. You don't buy stock because you just want to look cool. You buy stock as a rational investor because you want to make money. Understand this. The corporation has one and only one objective. That objective is to maximize the shareholders' wealth. That is the only thing the company cares about, is maximizing its owners' wealth. We can talk all we want about, oh, we want to help Mother Earth, or we believe in our employees, they're the most important thing about our company, or we want to help our country be greater. Bull! We lie about those things. The reality is that if I don't make you happy as a shareholder, you know what you're going to do to my CEO? But you're going to fire it. You're going to kick me out because you have the power to do that. So I better care about you before everything else. Now, if it makes good money for me to talk about how wonderful I love Mother Gaia and want to do green technology, wonderful. If it makes me more money, if I help you along, help people along the way, do charitable things, as long as that gets me good press and makes people buy my product, which ups my revenue, which ups my profit, then I will do it. But I won't do things that are adverse to you, my owner, because you, my owner, can whoop my ass back down off the corporate executive suite. You understand that? So when we talk about stakeholders, a lot of that is just fluff. Well, our stakeholders include our consumers, our country, our workers. Those are stakeholders. Wonderful. If that makes you a buck, say it. You understand that we are in a world of greed. Greed is not an offensive thing. And I go into a little routine right here. You, sir, right there, you are a bread maker. You make bread. Now, you are the only bread maker in town. So you don't really care how much you charge because people have to buy your bread. So you can waste resources. You take handfuls of flour and you throw it in, and a half of it falls on the floor. Oh, well, I'm going to have to charge more this week. You hire your lazy-ass brother who sits in the basement eating Cheetos and playing Call of Duty and World of Warcraft. Really? World of Warcraft? You know, the old geezer's game now is turned into. Anyway, You can waste money because you can charge whatever you want for your product because no one else does it. Now, the world is a greedy place. Have you ever seen someone who has too much money for his own good? Some son of a bitch, he's got a nice car and he's an ass. Yeah, here he is. You can do the same thing he does, but all you have to do is control your resource usage, not waste resources, get rid of employees that are useless, and you can make bread at a lower cost and therefore sell it at a lower price. That process is called static efficiency. Static efficiency. Using the same technology, but with fewer resources. Static efficiency. You're doing it entirely because you want to take that man's money because you deserve it more than he does. That's just the reality of it. But here we have this lady. She looks at you and says, well, I could do this, but what I do is I'd use less labor and I'd use more machinery because the machines would cost less than the people. I'd also probably kind of like use a different combination of wheats that are cheaper and maybe a few other things. You see, what she is doing is she is shifting the technology, the way the factors of production go together. And she can then charge an even lower price because her costs are even lower. That's called dynamic efficiency. Dynamic efficiency is using a new technology to save resources and therefore charge a lower price. Do you understand in this process the pure essence of competitive markets? The pinnacle of capitalism is the competitive markets. They are charging, he's charging a lower price for the bread. Not because he loves his customers, but because he wants to make money off them and take away his business. So the world is better because he is using resources more efficiently. The same goes for you. You want to sell bread at a lower price, not because you love customers. Not really even because you love bread, but because you want to take away his money and have it for yourself. In other words, you want to drive, he wants to drive that guy out of business, and you want to drive that guy into bankruptcy. You want to break their backs and make their kids go to Illinois State University instead of the University of Illinois. I did not say that. Right. I meant to say that the other way. I still have to edit these podcasts someday. Madam, concentrate. Do you understand? Shut up. Do you understand that this process betters the world? Because we have cheaper products, we use fewer resources, and it has nothing to do with loving the world, loving your customers, or any of that sentimental nonsense. And you're saying, well, that's an awfully cruel view of the world. What do you do? Don't you have any friends, fat boy? No, I don't. I have cats. But understand this, it doesn't end there. Suppose that you get a reputation that you're deciding where you're going to buy bread, and you say, well, you suggest, well, let's go eat, get some of her bread, and you say, no, I've heard her bread tastes like ass. And you say, well, I don't want that. I mean, that doesn't taste good at all. God, it's warm in this damn classroom. But you understand that you can't... you can't just make a bread that's nasty. You have to make a product that won't kill your What are you going to do? People, some mom takes her kid in there. No, mommy, I don't want that bread. That bread tastes like ass. Oh, shut up. Your kid's starving in China. He'd love to have an ass sandwich. No. You have to maintain a certain amount of quality with your product or you will lose the business that you gain. So that is one of the stops on this pure greed. But understand that at the bottom line in our business, greed is not bad. Greed is good. Greed drives us to do the most efficient thing. If I can create an artificial intelligence that costs me $10,000 a year to run, then I'm going to fire all of you expensive $60,000 a year employees and save myself not just a salary, but all those sicky poo days I have to pay for and the retirement. With an AI, I just switch the son of a bitch off. Do you understand? That's why you're going to be replaced. That's why I will eventually be replaced. Because this system has at its end the absolute lack of sentiment for the consumer, for anything in the way of the most efficient means of production. And that's how, unfortunately, the only thing that stops it at that point is revolutions. They usually don't work, but there's that. Now, going on here, though, the last topic that I should talk about here is that you are driving, these companies are driving to make their stock price go up. That's my job. If I am on the board of directors, the shareholders have elected me. Now, sometimes that, it's really bad though. These days there's such an old boys network. It's like the board of directors is elected by the majority shareholders, who are usually these massive pension funds and Wall Street. So there's a really nasty part in it. European countries have made it so that that incestuous relationship between the majority shareholders and the board cannot happen like it can here in the United States. And that's one of the great flaws that we need to fix. And it ain't going to be fixed. Unfortunately, the politicians who would fix it would also fix other things they shouldn't fix. But there's that. Okay, but anyway, theoretically, the board of directors is elected by the shareholders. Then the board hires the executive management. And then the executive management hires all the other people. So ultimately, if the shareholders are not happy, they will get rid of the board of directors. They will vote them out, and then new board directors will come in, and they will fire the executives. Like I said, here in the United States, the process does not work as efficiently as it does in European countries because of this locked-in old boys network. And literally, it is an old white boys network, which is one of the big problems. However, at the end of the day, if we don't make the stock price go up, eventually we're going to get our butts fired. So we ultimately have one and only one goal. That is to maximize the shareholder wealth. The way you maximize it is you increase the stock price. No matter what else you do, if you can't make that stock price keep going up, or at least make nice dividends reliably available, then you're not going to be kept as the managers, the executives, and the board of directors. So we need to get that stock price to go up. That's where you, as the investors, come in. You buy stocks. You buy bonds. You sell stocks. You sell bonds. We want you to assess the investment in our company as worthy of your money, actually capital. If you're buying stocks or bonds, you're using your capital because these are long-term investments. At least they should be. So at the end of the day, in finance, one of our big, big purposes is to determine whether or not a stock price has a good chance of going up or not. No one can predict stock prices. Anyone who tells you otherwise is a liar. Anyone who tries to sell you a product where they promise their routine, their software, their methods will guarantee you a return, you know that you've got a phony on your hands. These guys on these financial news networks like Jim Cramer and other deformed mentalists like him, they're selling you a bill of goods. You know how I make money off people like you? I find the suckers who believe me. Now, do you understand this? You go on YouTube, you'll find thousands of people. I've made a lot of money, okay? This is like the people on the lottery. You get this guy. I made money with my patented system for predicting what stocks will go up, and I will sell it to you for $19.95 with shipping and handling. Wait, it's coming downloaded. Well, there's shipping over the internet wires. The first question you should ask, if this guy has made that much money, why is he sharing his secrets with you, which would ruin his routine because you'd use it too, and then it would blow it? The second thing you have to ask yourself, okay, for every winner in the stock market who uses some fancy system, it's the same as with the lottery. You will hear about the ones who won. You will never hear about the millions who lost. How often do you see someone on TV, "Hi, I've got a system that made me a poor man in a matter of only 3 years, and I want to sell you my system too"? You're not going to see it. You will buy it. You will see a bias toward the winners. Well, this person won the lottery, so you should buy some lottery tickets. No, that son of a bitch won the lottery, and 10 million people didn't that week. It's the same thing as we see this phenomenon in physics. Interestingly enough, when you see cars on a highway, well, everyone's going faster than the speed limit. Actually, you're seeing only the cars that are breaking the speed limit, because those are the only ones who will pass you. So you get the sense that everyone breaks the law, and so it's okay for you to break the law too, because everyone does it. Until you realize that the only reason you saw those lawbreakers is because you were abiding by the rules. Think about those things before you go and buy some software for predicting stock prices. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.